How do you know if something is a sign of the second coming? You know that critics of Adventists say that we see a Sunday law behind every rock and every bush, and everything is a sign. Well, this lady said the right answer. It's a sign when Jesus said it was a sign. Isn't that true? So we're going to see some of those. Where would we look in the Bible to find signs anyway? Matthew 24 is a good one. We're still getting some ringing out of this microphone over here. Maybe it's facing me too much. Okay. Can you turn the volume down just a little bit? Maybe just the master some. Is that better? Okay. There's another one where the characteristics of end time people are listed. And if you'd like to turn there, it's 2 Timothy, the 3rd chapter. This is very familiar to most people. But it says, this is chapter 3 of 2 Timothy, the first few verses. But know this, that the last days perilous times will come. Men will be lovers of themselves, or selfish. Would that describe our day? Lovers of money. Boasters, proud, blasphemous, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. Now this is kind of interesting. We call ourselves Christians, but we don't think God has the power to change our hearts. Do you see what I'm saying? Kind of interesting. And it says, from such people turn away. I don't think that we want to neglect people who need the Lord, but it's the fact that we want to maintain our closest association with those people who are on their way to the kingdom, so we can help one another do that. Well, I'm going to tell you something interesting about the signs this afternoon before I tell you what I think they are, or the seven ones. By the way, there are many. I just picked seven of the ones that I think are really unmistakable signs of the end. To me, it's very interesting that, from my perspective, no one, even the wicked, will be surprised by the second coming. You understand, yesterday we talked about it would be like a thief in the night to the wicked. Let me just tell you something. If you read Revelation chapter 16, it talks about the seven last plagues. You remember reading that, don't you? I'm just going to talk about a little bit. Number one is the foul and loathsome sores or boils are on people. And it apparently is not just isolated, but, you know, huge groups of people get these boils. The second one, the seas turn to blood. You can imagine the result of the value of resort property about that time. Rivers and springs turn to blood. The fourth one, the sun's power is increased to the point that men are scorched, which I think is interesting. A fifth one is there's great darkness on the earth. The sixth one is the battle of Armageddon, the forces of good and evil fighting each other. You understand that when these things begin to happen, that is the signal that probation has closed. But it happens before Jesus literally comes to the earth. No one is going to be wondering then about who's going to win the NASCAR championship. Do you understand that? It's very important. Who's going to win the basketball tournaments or the World Series or anything. That stuff will be absolutely meaningless. Everyone will know that Jesus' coming is near. And the real bottom line is, will we be ready? Those who heed the signs, I think, will be ready. And that's the important thing that we want to look at today. We're going to review some signs. Sometimes we're right in the middle of signs. In other words, you've heard the expression, you can't see the forest for the trees. Well, I'm going to ask you an interesting question right now. And I'm sure we're going to get a few hands on this one, maybe only a few. How many of you were born after 1969? Yeah, put them right up there. We got a lot of young people here. Okay, good. Well, to young people, signs of the end of time are so abundant that they hardly recognize them as signs. And in just a few minutes, I'll show you why I mentioned that time thing. So you'll understand. But what we're going to look at is a bunch of signs. But I want to first of all talk to you about this promise. If you were in the 11 o'clock meeting this morning, you know how much I believe in God's Word. And these words are written in red in my Bible, which means Jesus said them himself. And he has the present ability to do whatever he wants to do. And he said, I will come again. And I believe that. Now that's the real bottom line of what we're looking at as far as end time things. So one time when Jesus was here on earth, maybe we should just read it in the Bible, because in Matthew 24 verse 3, you need to actually get the setting a little bit. And what it says, as Jesus sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him. What's the next word? Anybody know? Privately. So this is not a big meeting to lots of thousands of people. It's just the inner circle. And they said to him, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Now, you know that you can talk to your close friends about things that you just can't talk to everybody about. And Jesus really unburdened himself, and he told them lots of things to expect that they would see before the end. He also told them, as I showed you yesterday, to encourage them to study the book of Daniel. Do you remember that? How do you read in the book of Daniel? Well, I'm just going to show you. My first one is increase of knowledge. And I'm going to show you something here. Daniel 12 verse 4 says, at the time of the end, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. I heard a skeptic one time say, if I ever hear another Adventist speaker say that the increase of knowledge is a sign of the end, I'm going to, you know, whatever. And I hope that person is here today, because you're going to hear one. And I will just tell you this. I know, and you know, that the primary application of this verse is that the knowledge of Daniel's prophecies would increase. Isn't that right? In other words, God had said, close the book and seal it up till the time of the end. Then many would run to and fro and knowledge would be increased. But Adventist preachers and evangelists, including James and Ellen White, have also used this as a secondary application of knowledge of communication and travel would increase to facilitate the spread of the gospel worldwide. Now, this is going to be really interesting, as you can understand. This is just an artist's conception of the Garden of Eden. But since that time, if a man or woman or young person wanted to travel faster than they could walk or run, how would they do it? There's clues in the picture, the biggest thing there. You either ride on a horse or get towed by one. Isn't that true? I mean, that's the way it is. There are people alive today that remember the days of horse and buggy, even so. All down through time, whenever the big wars came, when you read about Solomon, how he got his horses from Egypt, his Arabian horses, you know, all that stuff. Ethiopian eunuch, he was being towed by a horse, and that Philip joined him for the baptism. You remember that? You know, through the Middle Ages, really amazing. Napoleon's famous white horse. Now, here's something very, very interesting. I'm going to go back and just read something before I show you that picture. To me, it's very fascinating that if you were to make a timeline from that wall over there to this one and say it's the 6,000 years of Earth's history, for 5,900 years, the primary means of transportation was riding on a horse or getting towed by one. Isn't that true? But it happened right here in your conference something like 104 years ago. It was 1903, December 17, the historic day, that windy day on the dunes of the Outer Banks here of North Carolina, when the Wright brothers first flew. Now, I happen to be a person who likes details, and I'll just tell you something interesting. How many brothers were there? Two, Orville and Wilbur. How do you know which one got to ride? Well, they didn't know. They actually flipped the coin, and the guy that won was the one who rode, and Orville won the toss. So he was at the controls of the Wright Flyer. They actually tried it on the day before, December 16, and the first attempt, it crashed and broke. So they fixed it all up, and the next day, they were so confident that it would fly. I'm going to tell you guys something really, really interesting now. They dressed up in suits, and they hired a photographer to come and take a picture because they were sure it would fly. Now, the reason I'm going to tell you something interesting is I'm probably the only guy here with a tie on. And the reason that I wear one is to increase my credibility a little bit. But more than that, is I work for somebody who's pretty special, and I just want to honor him by wearing a tie today. But anyway, if you look at early Adventist camp meeting pictures, all of the people in the audience also had shirts and ties and the men's with vests on, all buttoned up, as hot as everything, and they're all dressed up like that. And well, it's a different age. But the fact is, back those days, here's Wilbur out here. He's just let go of the wing. It's run down this track. And the interesting thing is it wasn't much of a flight. The plane was only airborne for 12 seconds. And it was 120 feet in length that it was airborne. Later that same day, the last flight of the day, Wilbur was at the controls. He flew at 852 feet and was airborne 59 seconds. Now, the interesting thing about all of this, this changed transportation forever. Because the interesting thing, it wasn't another 6,000 years, but only 66 years later, when most of you here, this is the 1969 thing, can remember on July 20, 1969, the voice of Apollo 11 commander Neil Armstrong, when he said, "Houston, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed." And to me, that was one of the most amazing things. You know, there's still people that don't believe that happened, but the fact is, we spent a lot of money to get to the moon, which, by the way, is the closest object to Earth, as you know. Any other planet that we would try to go to, you'd have to take, you know, male and female, have children on the way to, you know, somebody eventually get there. But it was such a huge undertaking that man actually walked on the moon. One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. And knowledge and communication and travel continues with computers. Somebody took my picture today with a film camera. I couldn't believe they still had one. And the fact is, most everybody uses digital cameras now. Isn't that true? Because you can take a picture today and send it tonight to your children in Florida without any change in the picture. The digital quality goes right along with it. You can do all kinds of enhancements. You don't have to send it off to Walmart or anything. I mean, it's already ready to use in most cases. We have the GPS systems, much, much more. But the increase of knowledge has really, really been significant. I mean, there's hardly anything that you could imagine that was the same just 100 years ago. Most of you have seen most of it happen yourself. From horseback to the moon in one century. So if you were ever a person that liked to do these plots, you know, for time and distance, if you have increase in communication and travel, you have a flat line for 5,900 years. This is travel. And then it goes straight to the moon. Isn't that incredible? Clear to the moon, literally. To the moon. And this is, to me, an increase of knowledge. I mean, if you stand back and look at the big picture, you would have to be foolish not to say something's happened. I mean, this is, to me, amazing. Even much more than the Renaissance and Industrial Revolution, all of that. To me, it's really quite amazing. We're going to look now at this one, Wars and Rumors of Wars. Our son Andrew is a history major. He actually had history and English double major. But he said that, he told me one time, history is only the accounting of who killed who under what circumstances. The whole thing is wars. Who was the strongest guy in the wars? I mean, that's pretty much it, isn't it? Wars and rumors of wars. I mean, there have been people killing one another since Cain killed Abel. And as I told you today, Kathy and I read the Bible through every year together. When you read through the Old Testament, thousands and thousands of people were killed in battle. I mean, it's incredible. One of the most incredible things about the Old Testament is that there were times when Israel and Judah fought each other and killed their own people. This is incredible that this happened. So how could a war ever be a sign of the end if there have been so many wars? In order to be a sign, it would have to be a bigger war and more significant than any wars that have ever occurred. Isn't that true? You're going to see this in just a moment. The Bible says there would be wars and rumors of wars. Nation would rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and so on. The last century has been the bloodiest of all. Now, this to me is very amazing when you look at it. Most of you know that what you're looking at here is a mushroom cloud from an atomic explosion. The atomic explosions, this one is the picture of the one that was actually a practice one and one that totally decimated an island in the Pacific. But when they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, most of you have read about it. To me, it's quite amazing when you think about it, what happened there. I think it was August 6, 1945, when a specially equipped B-29 bomber took off from Tinian Island in Central Pacific, headed for Japan. It started off at 2:45 a.m. in the morning. Colonel Paul Tibbetts was at the controls as the pilot. He was told, the bomb you're going to drop is like nothing else you've ever dropped before. As a matter of fact, they said, we do not know the full reaction of it. Our suggestion is that you bank and get out of there as quickly as you drop it. Because in the test, these clouds of superheated flames and gas shot up 40,000 feet. And in those days, prop planes couldn't even fly that high. So they didn't know what to expect. But when at 8 o'clock in the morning, the Enola Gay, by the way, that name was his mother's name. He got up early in the morning. Maybe he stayed up all night. But as was the custom for a special mission, he wrote in paint on the side of the fuselage of the B-29 Enola Gay because he wasn't sure he would even return. By the way, that very plane is on display in Washington, D.C., as you may know, out near Dulles Airport at the Air and Space Museum, which is kind of an interesting thing, which means that he made it back. At any rate, when he dropped the bomb, the bombardier in those days had to sight it. It wasn't radio controlled like we have now. But he sighted it on that bridge between the two sections of Hiroshima. A real amazing thing. It was a munitions area. And when they dropped the bomb, Kathy and I have visited Hiroshima, and it is very, very, very significant to visit the museum there. When the bomb dropped, everything for 6 miles was level to only 18 inches, except one single building stayed up with a few prongs on it. For a 3 mile radius in all directions, everything 18 inches. 110,000 people were killed in less than a minute. It's just an incredible thing. The reason, if you don't know, the reason that President Bush and others are so fixated upon weapons of mass destruction is that that little fat boy that they dropped over there was a baby compared to what we have now. I mean, we could destroy the world over many times if a nuclear war ever developed, as you know. By the way, it is likely there will not be a third world war for that very reason. Because the Bible indicates when Jesus returns, it's not after a nuclear holocaust and people are coming out with three eyes and, you know, scum all over them and so on. The fact is, what are they doing? They're building and marrying and eating and drinking, you understand, carrying on normal life. That's the point. But the fact is, that thing, it was very, very incredible. World War II killed more people, cost more money, damaged more property, affected more people, and probably caused more far-reaching changes than any war in history. The number of people that were killed in World War I and World War II can probably never be accurately counted. However, modern estimates place the estimate of military and civilian personnel at 69 million. So we're talking about lots and lots of people. As a matter of fact, the people that were killed in the last century in those two wars, more people were killed in World War I and World War II than all of the Earth's other battles combined. So you understand it is a big deal. And the, by the way, something interesting, you say, well, that's in the last century. But let's just read in our Bible when you see it there. Because Matthew 24, verse 6, it says something very interesting. It says, you'll see, hear of wars and rumors of war. See that you're not troubled. All these things must come to pass. But what? The end is not yet. That lets you know you're near the end, but a lot of other things will need to happen. And those are the kind of things that we're going to look at in the next few minutes. And I think that they're really amazing. I've already told you this here, more people killed. It's amazing. The lack of self-control. There's a lot of things that you could talk about here. The Bible talks about it also as unnatural affection. I mean, there's just, the list could go on and on. I remember when I was a student at Southern years ago, actually I hitchhiked home to Nashville and back several times. But today it's illegal. You hardly ever see anyone hitchhiking. Why is that the case? It's not safe for the person picking them up or to get picked up. I mean, you don't know what kind of a weirdo might pick you up. It would be more dangerous to, you know, stand out and you know, get picked up than to stand out in the street sometimes. It's just really awful. But I'll tell you something else very interesting about this, and I'm just going to share this with you. Some time ago, when Bill Clinton was our president, mayor of New York was Rudy Giuliani, and the governor of Maryland, where I live, was Paris Clendenning. And they all had something in common. And that was that they had all been unfaithful to their spouse while holding high public office and expected the people to continue to support them, because that's just the way it is now. As a matter of fact, you are likely aware that in the Republican side of the current presidential race, only one person still has his first wife, and that's Mitt Romney. It's kind of an interesting thing. Everyone else is on their second or third wife. It's just incredible when you think about it. And this is today's where we live. And this is lack of self-control. Do you understand? I mean, that's one of the things the Bible talks about. Okay, we talk about violence, about gambling. It's just amazing. Pornography. I'm going to tell you something really interesting, and please don't try this at home. I'm glad there's not any little kids here. In order to illustrate my sermons, and I've just started doing that. I don't know if it's helpful or not to have slides, but I think it might be. At any rate, I wanted a picture of Adam and Eve leaving the Garden of Eden. And that's a picture I think I'll show you tomorrow sometime. At any rate, my secretary or administrative assistant is Lori Bryan, and she does most of my PowerPoint stuff. But sometimes when I'm out by myself, I have to find a picture and do it. So I just did Google, you know, Adam and Eve picture. I got about 8 websites of pornographic stuff. This is incredible. Don't try it. I'm just telling you that's what you'll find. The whole point, praise God, I didn't click on any of them because I know I don't want any of that stuff on my computer. You know, the leader of Princeton Theological Seminary lost his job because of child pornography on his laptop. You know, understand? So, you know, I'm not interested, but I'm just telling you that's what you see today. And corrupt government leaders, greed and fraudulent business practices, and you could go Enron, and just the list could go on and on and on. Violence, immorality on television, crime out of control, selfishness abounds. Is this describing our day? I mean, this is only one element. To me, it's very interesting when you see that. I'm going kind of quickly because I want to show you the sixth one is really the most significant. And this one is interesting, earthquakes. Matthew 24, verse 7 says there will be famines, pestilence, and earthquakes in various places. Now, the reason that I mention earthquakes, fortunately, this part of the country is reasonably stable. Did you hear what I said? But if you live around the Pacific Rim area, the third camp meeting I go to this summer is in Alaska, and they have earthquakes in Alaska every day. Every day. And some of them are, you know, just little ones. You may not feel them. But, you know, you've seen pictures of the big earthquake they had there when, you know, it's incredible the damage that was done. This is part of the Pacific Rim area. You know, all the way around the Pacific, they're having these things. I'll just give you an illustration, however. In Matthew 24, verse 7, in Mark 14, and in Luke 21. So the reason I mentioned that, you know the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are called what Gospels? Synoptic Gospels, which means they essentially tell the same story. The fact is, all three of them mention, when you see more earthquakes, you know the end is near. I'll tell you just one experience I had. In 1994, I was speaking out in California, and I was staying at a hotel in Long Beach. And because I was from the East Coast, and every one of us has circadian rhythms, and most of us probably do not set alarm clocks. I don't. I always wake up at 5 or 5:30 every morning, and that's what I do. The thing I'm going to tell you is, because I was in California and I'm from the back east, I was waking up at the normal time that I would have, and that's at 4 o'clock in the morning, California time. And I was awake, and I realized this is kind of dumb because everybody else is going to be sleeping a couple of hours. The fact is, though, my bed started shaking. And I thought, I think we must be having an earthquake. And then it got really rugged, and it got so bad that most of you have seen these televisions that are on stands. You know, they're bolted to the ground so people can't steal them. It shook so hard the television fell off its stand. And I didn't know what to do, so I ran for the bathroom because I wanted to get into a transom, you know, where there's a window, a doorway. And while I was in the transom, water was sloshing out of the commode. I mean, it was just really rugged. And I don't mind telling you, I prayed out loud, God, please spare my life. Now, this was the Northridge earthquake. Most of you have seen it. We were 35 miles from the epicenter. It was so rugged that I didn't know if our hotel would survive 35 miles away. At any rate, I thought, well, what should I do? And I always carry blue jeans with me, and so I grabbed my blue jeans and put them on, and I thought to myself, well, maybe I should try to get out. And then I realized that outside my window was a little balcony. And you know how sometimes your whole life flashes in front of you? Well, what happened to me was I remembered seeing pictures of the great Mexico City earthquake where all the balconies had sheared off and people's beds were sticking out. So I wasn't going to go out there. Then I remembered when I came in last night, some of you know the Park Ridge Hotel in Gatlinburg where we have the It Is Written partnerships. You've been there probably. Is it Park Vista? Yeah. Okay. Anyway, it's a round hotel with balconies on the inside. When you get out of your elevator, you have to walk around this balcony. That hotel was like that too. So I figured I shouldn't go out there either because you could, on the seventh floor, look all the way down to the restaurant and these plastic trees and all that stuff. So what I did is I went over and I called the downstairs desk, and the young man, I could tell he was scared. He said, "Good morning, Mr. Reed." You know, this is modern technology. He knew who I was by just me calling down there. And I said, "I know we've just had an earthquake. What's the protocol?" He said, "Don't worry a thing about it. We have these things out here all the time." I'm going to tell you two more things about it because to me it's really significant. I still remember it as if it were yesterday. I said to him, "You might have them all the time, but you're going to learn something today, right now. This is not normal. God is trying to tell us the end of time is near." You see what I'm telling you? Now, here, I'm going to tell you two other things about this. When I went down to breakfast 2 hours later, we were still having these aftershocks, you know, just two or three on the Richter scale. This one was almost a 7. It was like 6.9. At any rate, I asked one of my friends from the Atlantic Union, who had never been through an earthquake either, "What did you do when the earthquake came?" Because I knew he would have been awake too, because his clock would have had woken him up by that time. Here's what he said. He said, "I did not know what to do. Join the club, I didn't know either. But," he said, "I got up and got dressed in my suit and my white shirt and tie and my shoes, and I got right back in bed." He said, "I didn't want them to find me without my clothes on," is what he said. So I know he was petrified. It was really, really incredible. Earthquakes are not normal. Whenever you hear of a tsunami that kills 275,000 people in 8 hours, triggered by an underwater earthquake, you know God is trying to tell us something. You get the point? Well, maybe enough on earthquakes. Okay. 6,000 major earthquakes every year. There's many things I could tell you about earthquakes. I will tell you one more thing about pestilence. When if you've read the history of America, most of you understand why one of the great plagues in Utah when those big, what do they call those big locust things that came and ate all the crops of people? And the Bible says there'll be famines and pestilence, earthquakes, various places. But since the mid-1970s, more than 30 new diseases have emerged, including AIDS. Remember, 30 years ago, nobody, not doctors or nurses, had ever heard of HIV or AIDS. Since that time, more than 20 million people have died of AIDS. Kathy and I just came back in April from 2 weeks in South Africa, and do you understand there are countries in South Africa where 1 in 5 people have AIDS? 20% of the population, including people in high-level government positions, teachers, you know, military people, and so on. And in sub-Saharan Africa now, there are 12 million AIDS orphans who have lost both parents to AIDS. 12 million. You've seen it on TV. Little children, 10 years old, the leader of their family. You understand. This is incredible. And, of course, Ebola, Lyme disease, SARS. And we can add to this list the avian or bird flu that, according to health authorities, has the potential to cause a pandemic health crisis. Have you heard that word, pandemic health crisis, with the bird flu? Well, here's the reason. The annual winter flu that, you know, comes to America every winter has a mortality rate of 3 or 4%. That means if 100 people get the flu, 3 or 4 of them will die. And they're either very old people or they're infants. You understand that their immune system is not functioning properly. But so far, the bird flu has a mortality rate of 50%. That means half the people that get it will die from it. And there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, it's just really, really quite incredible. They're trying right now, but you know the statistics are that if it came to America now, what would you do? Who would get the vaccine? How much is there? Those kinds of things are quite interesting. Now, here's one that I want to show you that we'll spend a little bit of time on. And this is the one, the union of church and state. There are a number of things we could say about this, but I will just tell you that in our country, there are a lot of things happening in this idea of the union of church and state. This is the White House photo on their website of the President Bush. Right after President Bush was first elected, you may remember that he went to the Vatican and is here getting a lecture from the Pope. This is Pope John Paul II, of course. The men behind are the interpreters, and of course between them the Virgin Mary. This is kind of an interesting picture. I was speaking at the Soquel, California camp meeting, and one of the people at camp meeting brought me this picture because it's not a real sharp picture because I scanned it off of the Los Angeles Times, the front page. And it's off of a newspaper. But there's several interesting things about it. President Bush appears to be sitting at attention while getting a reading from the Pope. And when later asked about it, he said, and these were his words as I can recall them, "I remember when Bill Clinton got this speech, he went to sleep, and the main thing I didn't want to do was go to sleep." So he's sitting there listening. Very interesting. When they opened the John Paul II Cultural Center in Washington, D.C., it's on the campus of Catholic University, the President of the United States was the main speaker and also was the one who cut the ribbon to open that. The Vatican calls this the Little Vatican, you know, in America. It's kind of interesting because almost all of the cardinals in America were there at that time. Those of you who follow Catholic activity, I subscribe to our Sunday Visitor, which is a weekly Roman Catholic paper, and also Inside the Vatican, which is like a 78-page color magazine that's a big magazine, like Time magazine, although it's slick paper and very pretty. That magazine is edited in the Vatican. It's sent on a modem, which is quite amazing, over to a monastery in New Hope, Kentucky, where it's translated into English and sent to all the English subscribers. But at any rate, if you've watched that, you'll remember this person right here. And his facial features are what primarily gives him away. This is Cardinal Bernard Law from the Boston Archdiocese, who lost his job because of pedophilia. You remember that. But he didn't go to jail or anything. He actually was taken to the Vatican and given a Vatican position. And he actually was one of the people who voted for the current Pope, which is kind of interesting. I don't want to get too much onto this. I will just tell you this one interesting thing. Early on, when the pedophilia scandal came to light, people were saying, well, this is an isolated incident in Boston and the press is making a mountain out of a molehill. You know that there are 58 conferences in the United States and Canada. In that same territory, the Roman Catholic Church has 172 archdioceses, which would be similar to one of our conferences. Listen carefully. Every one of them have multiple pedophile cases, and the church now has paid out more than $1 billion in reparations to victims. It's very, very incredible when you think about it. I'm just going to show you this because it's rather old news, but Jim Nicholson, who was the chairman of the Republican National Committee from 97 to 2000, who was essentially the primary politician who orchestrated putting President Bush in office for the first term, after that, he was awarded to be the U.S. ambassador to the Vatican. He's been called back in Bush's second term, and he now heads up the Veterans Affairs in the Bush cabinet. A very interesting and prominent man, but that's the position he had. I've only kept this picture in to show you this. The Holy See, that's the central government of the Roman Catholic Church, now has full diplomatic relations with 172 nations out of the 228 recognized as sovereign nations by the United Nations. That means more than three-fourths of every sovereign nation on earth has full diplomatic relations with the Vatican, which means that they send an ambassador to the Vatican, and the Vatican will send someone at cardinal level to that country who has direct access to the leaders of that country, which is kind of interesting, and especially when you see what I'm going to show you in a few minutes. Most of you are likely aware that Jerry Falwell died a couple of weeks ago, and it's very interesting that he was in the newspapers of many magazines and is credited for a lot of work in organizing Christians to become involved in politics. But this is a picture of Jerry Falwell at Liberty University, and this man is also very well known, Karl Rove, who is the political leader for President Bush. And he's been in and out of the news for a long time because of, you know, political things that he's involved in. But anyway, he went down to Liberty University before the last election, encouraged Jerry Falwell to speak on behalf of the president to get him reelected. There are many other things, and I'm not going to go into this so much because I'd like you to see more about this. Most of you have heard of James Dobson. Dr. Dobson, for all the good he has done, has felt convicted that he needs to get involved more in politics as well. And so before the last election, something interesting happened, and I'll show it to you from U.S. News and World Report. This is January 17, 2005. Of course, it's right after the results of the election were in. And this is the quote from U.S. News World Report. Before the election, that's November 2004, Dobson stepped down from the presidency of Focus. This is Focus on the Family. He's still chairman, but not president, to launch Focus on the Family Action, a fundraising and grassroots organizing engine free of political spending limits imposed on nonprofit Focus. Now, you know that any church or 501c3 organization cannot get involved in politics or they lose their tax-exempt status. So he started this new organization called Focus on the Family Action. And this move allowed Dobson to make his first presidential endorsement, which he did for President Bush, to write hundreds of thousands of Focus constituents in states with tight Senate races with political advice, and to appear in TV ads to unseat Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle in South Dakota. Now, the Senate Minority Leader was Tom Daschle. If you watch national news, you'd seen Daschle on television many, many times. But because he did not toe the line of the Christian Coalition and other groups, you, as you can see from this report, Dobson personally went in TV ads and in person to the television stations in South Dakota and spoke against Tom Daschle, and he was defeated, a United States senator. Later, Dobson stated, "Let this be a lesson to the other politicians. You vote with us or you may lose your job." Very interesting, very powerful. The president also presented the Medal of Freedom to Pope John Paul II when he was still alive during a visit to the Vatican in Rome. This was in 2004. And of course, when the Pope died, the president ordered the flag at the White House to be half-staff until the Pope was buried. Of course, there's the top of the flag and it's that half-staff. Now, the interesting thing about it, not only did the Pope ask the White House flag, but every government institution in the world, which means all of our embassies, all of our ships at sea and so on, to lower their flag at half staff. And I don't know if I ever thought I would see what I saw next, but Cardinal McCarrick, who is now retired, was the Cardinal of Washington, D.C. President Mrs. Bush went to the Roman Catholic Mass for the president in Washington. And, of course, the Pope, at the time of his death, appeared on the cover of Time magazine. But to give you a little idea of the popularity of the Pope actually appeared a record 16 times on the cover of Time magazine. And this is actually from Time magazine itself. They had all the pictures together of all the times that he was on the cover of Time magazine. Newsweek said, under John Paul II, who helped bring down the Iron Curtain, the Holy See gained more political clout than it had enjoyed since the Renaissance. And Revelation 13, I know some of the other speakers are talking about it. On Thursday, I've promised to talk about Revelation 13, 16 to 18, when we talk about Vicarius Filii Dei and the 666. I think you'll appreciate seeing it from that perspective. But anyway, the verse in verse 3 says, "I saw one of his heads as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast." Now, you know what picture I'm going to show you next, because up until the death of this pope, no U.S. president had ever been to a papal funeral. But in this particular case, we had George W. Bush, Mrs. Bush, Laura Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, President Clinton, Condoleezza Rice, Andy Card, and the list goes on back there. By the way, here is the man I just showed you earlier, who is the U.S. ambassador at that time to the Vatican, which was Jim Nicholson. It's real interesting because this is USA Today. The President Bush, his wife Laura, his father, former President George Bush, former President Bill Clinton, and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, knelt in a pew in front of the body, bowing their heads. This is, you know, giving some reverence to the Pope in the Vatican, which was very interesting. And the Vatican said that kings and presidents, prime ministers, heads of state from more than 100 countries attended the funeral of the Pope. It was the largest funeral in world history, watched by over 2 billion on television. Isn't that incredible? It was the largest gathering of political leaders in the history of Earth, including all the Olympic Games or everything else, the most people. As a matter of fact, Jimmy Carter also wanted to go to this, but the Vatican, knowing the huge crowds that would be there, you know that bus loads of people and train loads of people came from all over Europe, especially Poland and so on. There was not room for people, so they limited the U.S. delegation to the three presidents and their staff, so Jimmy Carter did not go. At least I don't believe he went. There's no pictures of him that I'm aware of. From the papal balcony, the former Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger is introduced as the new Pope Benedict XVI. It's kind of interesting, for those of you who study popes at all, and some of you have read Peter DeRosa's History of the Popes, the Benedict name is kind of interesting because back in the Middle Ages there was a Benedict VI that was the Pope three different times. He was a pope and decided he didn't like it, so he sold it to someone else, decided he wanted it back, and took it back. And then he went out again and decided he wanted it back again, and he was pope three different times. His name was Benedict. You look it up and you can see. Now, the interesting part about Benedict XVI, or Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, is that for the past 24 years before being elected as the pope, he led the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, formerly called the Office of the Holy Inquisition. That was his job. And so it should not be a surprise to any of you to note that this current pope is bringing the Roman Church back away from the reforms of Vatican II. For example, wanting to have the Mass only in Latin again and so on. You've seen that in the news. I mean, it's common information. To me, very interesting. So I'm going to show you the influence now of church and state in the various branches of the U.S. government. Most of you are well aware this is the U.S. Supreme Court. And 2 years ago, this is what the court looked like. This is 2 years ago. Scalia, a Roman Catholic, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Stevens, who is now 86 years old and still a justice, which is very interesting because when you're a justice, you are, you know, nominated for life. And it is common for him to sleep through proceedings in the U.S. Supreme Court, which is kind of interesting when you have a case there. The fact is, though, all the proceedings are recorded and their associates and the people who help them, they tell them what's going on, and then they caucus, you know, and they decide what they're going to do about it. But of course, the Chief Justice Rehnquist has since passed away. Sandra Day O'Connor has retired, and David Souter, of course, is there. Stephen Breyer is still there, and Clarence Thomas. But three of those in the past, three of them were Roman Catholic. But in George Bush's second term, something interesting happened, and that is, Justice Roberts, Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court now, he was first nominated to take Sandra Day O'Connor's place. But as you know, when Justice Rehnquist died before his confirmation, the president asked them to confirm him as the Chief Justice. Now, this is not a football jersey number. This is his age. At the age that he was when he went in, he's 51 years old now. I think he's the youngest justice in the Supreme Court. Harvard undergraduate, Harvard Law School, clerk for Justice William Rehnquist himself, devoted conservative, Roman Catholic. And then it's interesting that the Roman Catholic Church in Washington, D.C., under Cardinal McCarrick, who right here is with President and Mrs. Bush, and Chief Justice John Roberts and his wife, are coming out of the Washington Cathedral because they have the traditional red mass where the church blesses the justices of the Supreme Court. It's very interesting to see that because Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was also there. The three other Catholic justices also attended, Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy, along with Justice Breyer, who is Jewish. And Christian Today, this is not Christianity Today. This is a publication from Australia or England. Rob Schrenk, president of the National Clergy Council, also attended and stated, you had the heads of the executive, judicial branches, and representative of the legislative branch fully participating. There was no separation of church and state today. Everyone was at the Red Mass put on by the Roman Catholic Church. Then, when Sandra Day O'Connor still needed to have someone to replace her, President Bush introduced Samuel Alito, his choice to replace retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor on the U.S. Supreme Court. Alito was also described as a serious Roman Catholic. The interesting thing is, I mentioned before this happened that if Alito was confirmed to the Senate, the majority of justices of the Supreme Court will be Catholic, 5 out of 9. And I put this slide still in here because I want you to see this website right here. If you see adherence.com, you can see the religious persuasion of every federal judge, every Supreme Court justice, all of the governors of the United States, all the members of Congress, etc., which is just kind of interesting. And in 2005, they said it's more now, that there were 22 of the 50 state governors, 44% are Roman Catholic. And the U.S. and CNN today, when Alito was confirmed, the Senate today approved Judge Samuel Alito's lifetime appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. Alito is 55. So I'll show you the way the court looks today. And this is very interesting because some people wonder if President Bush did what the Christian right wanted him to do. And his primary job was to make the court more conservative, as you know. And so you have now five Roman Catholics, Justice Kennedy, of course, who's the one who wrote the majority opinion about 3 weeks ago in the U.S. Supreme Court case, Gonzalez versus Carhart, which upheld the state ban of partial birth abortion. Do you remember that? And it's interesting also that in that decision, Justice Kennedy wrote the majority opinion, and the other four Catholics joined him in the majority. So it was a 5-4 decision. The five Catholics all voted on the same side, which is kind of interesting when you understand what will be happening in the future. But, by the way, if you five people voted in favor and four against, well, the four against, they write what we call dicta, you know, the minority opinion. It's not a matter of law. It doesn't mean anything. You just need to know, you find out what they thought about it. But the fact is, if you have a case in the U.S. Supreme Court and you lose by one vote, what's your next option? You're just out of options. That's the court of last resort. So, I mean, that's the end of it for you. So this man is, of course, in deep water right now, but he also is a lifetime Roman Catholic and devoted friend of the president. I'm going to show you this, and it's going to take me a minute to tell you about it. But if you look at this, you can see something interesting. This is a map of the United States by state, but also by county. For example, those of you who have spent time in California may see that one of the biggest counties in California is right there. And Loma Linda happens to be in that county. Anybody know what county it is? San Bernardino County. It's right next to Riverside. That's true. Now, the real interesting thing about it, it's a big one, but probably I'm the only one that knows this because I went to law school in Georgia and my civil procedure teacher was a Georgia history trivia buff. And he knew how many counties there were in Georgia, the name of the county seat, and why they named it that. And he expected all of us to learn it. So I can just tell you that in the state of Georgia right here, there's no big places like San Bernardino County. They're all little counties right there. And there's 159 counties in Georgia. And when I lived in Georgia, I lived in Gordon County, where Calhoun is in the conference office for Georgia-Cumberland. In those days, praise God, we have, I think, four churches in the county now, but in those days, we only had one church, the Calhoun Church. And the interesting thing about it is that there were 87 Baptist churches in that county. So that's where we get the term Bible Belt. And that's what the red is here. This is Southern Baptist. This is where the Southern Baptists are predominant. A few years ago, the Roman Catholic Church had a goal of putting a resident priest in every county in the United States. That was accomplished. Now their goal, by the way, this is on the Glen Mary, G-L-E-N-M-A-R-Y, Glen Mary website, which is a Roman Catholic website. And it's very, very interesting because their goal now is to make Roman Catholicism the predominant religion in every county in the United States. This is on their website. It's the Roman Catholic. You can, you know, download it. I just scanned it off and put it on my computer or copied it off onto this site. But it's really, really interesting because the counties are the voting precincts and they go by the majority of votes, you understand. Now, here's something real interesting for you. I happen to be the person who's on the committee. I'm the secretary of the committee at the General Conference who decides we look over the Sabbath School Mission investment projects. And we're getting investment projects from Washington and Oregon and even British Columbia for special outreach to Hispanic people. They're wonderful people. They make good Adventists, really good Adventists. And the fact is the fastest growing segment of Adventism right now, as you may know. But at any rate, You have to wonder, when a lot of these people are coming over the border down here, how do they end up in Montana? If you ask them, do you know what they will tell you? The church paid our way up here. They are spreading people all over America. This is very, very interesting. You can see it on the internet right now. I mean, it's just incredible. The amazing thing then is that the blue here is Roman Catholic dominated counties. Almost all of the West is. Anybody know what the gray is here? Mormons. And the yellow up here in the Midwest is Lutheran. That's interesting. Have you ever heard, who's that guy that comes on Saturday night? Lake Wobegon? Yeah, he's always talking about the Lutheran minister, you know, because that's where the Lutherans are up there. Okay, Garrison Keillor. Okay, but look at see the Roman Catholic influence in this area over here, and of course along the south in this area. By the way, one of the major undertakings as far as building buildings is going on right now down in the state of Florida, where Ave Maria University is being built at Naples, Florida. I mean, they're starting a whole town, Ave Maria town in Florida. They've bought up, I don't know how much of the county there for this, but they're building a new school, a new law school even there. And it will be, you know, they also have a law school right here at South Bend, Indiana. But their goal, of course, is to evangelize from both sides. I mean, this is on the website. This is the Catholic website. I'm not just telling you my ideas. Very interesting stuff. Okay, we're going to look at the greatest sign now, and I want to tell you a little bit about what I think is really pretty awesome right now. Does anybody have a question or comment about what I just showed you with the religious world? There's much more happening, and I'll show you more tomorrow also about that. But I think it's very significant because these are things that are a fulfillment of Revelation 13. Yes, please.
How significant do you think it is that the Catholic Church and also evangelical Protestant groups are supporting the immigration bill to allow more immigration in one way or the other?
Well, it is very interesting. The question was, how significant is it that the Catholic Church is supporting immigration to America? It's kind of interesting that the border with the Catholic South is very porous, but if you're a person from some other country that wants to get here, good luck. You see what I'm saying? Is that true or not? It is true. I mean, you try to come here legally and it's almost impossible. The most amazing thing is, however, Roman Catholic priests have gone on record on national television even saying, anybody who comes to my church has safe passage and we're not going to send them back and so on. So it's very, very much encouraged. I actually subscribe, as I told you, to our Sunday Visitor, and there have been many articles in there about, you know, helping people come to America. Someone just gave me a paper that I took off the website about this very thing. By the way, not everything you see on the internet is true, but if you can take it from what you would call a legitimate source, like the Catholic News Service or, you know, CNN or someplace who typically check out their stories, I think you can find it is pretty credible. Yes, well, there are a lot of unusual statements. He said that one of the cardinals recently stated, if you're not in favor of immigration, your eternal life is kind of at stake. So, you know, people make a big deal out of it. Yes, please. Oh. Okay. Let me just tell you something interesting. The question was very good, and it's not funny. The question was, where are we on the map? Where's College Dale? Let me just tell you that. When you read through the Bible, there are two incredible stories in the Bible. One of them is that when Jonathan and his armor bearer took on the Philistines, just the two of them. You remember that? And what he told his armor bearer, it doesn't matter when God's on your side whether you have a big army or you're by yourself. Do you understand? And God gave them the victory. That, I think, is very, very important. One of the worst things David, as king of Israel, ever did, you know, second only to the Bathsheba experience, was he numbered Israel. Do you remember that? And the problem was, when he asked Joab to go out and his commander-in-chief to number all of Israel, Joab said, listen, don't do this. Don't do this. we're going to trust in our own strength, but God's always been the one that protected us. You know, this is really, but he did it anyway. Then the prophet came and said, you've displeased the Lord because you're trusting in men and not into him. And then he said, which of these three things would you like to have happen to you? You remember that? And David's answer was, let me fall into the hands of the Lord because he is the merciful one. And God killed 70,000 Israelites as a result of that dreadful experience. It's fascinating to me to understand, but it's still a good question. And the reason is the Southern Baptists have about 17 million people. The Roman Catholics have 63 million. And Seventh-day Adventists have 1 million. You see what I'm saying? So we really do not have the dominance in any county that I am personally aware of. And I know that we're not on the list down here. None to 1%. I don't know where there might be one. Maybe that's one there. I don't really know. But that's a good question. And as I said yesterday, I'm fixing to tell you some good news because it is really, really good what's happening. But I'm thankful. You know, Malachi Martin, who wrote that book, Keys of This Blood, called Adventists minimalists. You know, we're like a flea on the back of an elephant. You know, you wish they weren't there, but it doesn't really make a big difference whether you're there or not. But, you know, when you read the Bible, and that's why I really harped on that this morning, once you've got the Bible, you've got everything you need. I mean, this is really, really important stuff. You know who's going to win, what God can do? It's pretty amazing. But that's a good question. Anyone else have one on this church-state thing? Yes, please. It's called glenmary.org. G-L-E-N, 1-N, glenmary.org. And there's actually, believe it or not, there is no hiding the fact. They say it right on the website. We want Roman Catholicism to be the predominant religion in every county in the United States. And they have this map and other maps on there that you can see it yourself. It's really, yes, please.
Are there any dark counties still in the United States?
Oh, sure. There's lots of them. Lots of counties where there are no Seventh-day Adventists, you mean? But there is a church close enough for most people to commute, you know. I don't know if it's a Sabbath-based journey or not. You understand how far you have to go, but there are churches, a lot of churches. I'm going to tell you, you know, more about what's happening in our church in just a minute. But I wanted to stay with this as long as there may be a question or comment. Anybody else? Okay, let's go on. This to me is very, very good news. The gospel is going to all the world. And I'm going to actually tell you some interesting statistics about that. To me, I think it's pretty fascinating. I think that it is actually the greatest sign of the end, and that is the gospel is going to all the world. I know there are some people here who work with Adventist World Radio. I had the privilege of speaking to all of the leaders in the Southern Asia Pacific Division on stewardship topics. And on the way over there, I was the first weekend and the second weekend in Guam. And in Guam, it was really quite amazing. We have 14 churches in Guam, and I was at the Ghana Heights Church on Friday night and Sabbath with the finance seminar. And they were so interested, the leaders asked me to come back the next weekend and do it for the whole island. So they rented a church that's owned by Japanese Pentecostals in Guam that seats 6,000 people, and they closed all the Adventist churches in Guam and they all came back. That afternoon they had a baptism, and if you've ever seen a baptism that will bring tears to your eyes, standing on the side of a beautiful lagoon and hearing those people from Guam sing those awesome songs at sunset and had a baptism, it was just incredible. Really amazing. But what I wanted to tell you was, while I was there, I drove down to the southwest corner of that island, Guam, and I visited Adventist World Radio. And it's kind of like cliffs there where it is, the Adventist World Radio and the towers. And you can walk out there, and all you see is these big towers and the wires and so on, and all you can see, as far as you can see, is the Pacific Ocean. But what you know is that thousands and thousands of people have become Seventh-day Adventists listening to the Chinese language and other languages being broadcast 24 hours a day from Guam. And many of you helped to make that possible with your offerings from the 1990 General Conference. I mean, this is incredible what is happening. It's really, really amazing. I'll tell you a little bit more about it in a minute. 100 years ago, when the Wright brothers first flew that airplane that I showed you, there were only 75,000 Adventists in the whole world. 57,000 of them lived in the United States. That's very interesting. And that is most of them. Today, there are nearly 16 million church members worldwide, and more than 90% of them live outside the United States. And that's in over 200 countries around the world. 100 years ago, there was only one Adventist for every 24,000 people in the world. Does anybody know what the ratio is today? The ratio is one for every 468 worldwide. That includes the 1040 window and everything. It's incredible what God is doing. It's really, really amazing. Today, that ratio is 46 times better than it was 100 years ago. 100 years ago, we had mission work in 46 countries outside the United States. Today, we have established work in 204 countries out of the 228. Does anybody know why we don't have work in the other countries? That would be 24 countries. Well, they're Muslim countries and will not allow us in, for example. And I don't know how much you guys know about this, but if you visit the Washington, D.C. area where we live, just going out New Hampshire Avenue from the General Conference to all in the area where I live, there are churches from about every religion you can imagine, including, you know, Islamic mosques. They're all over. I mean, there are several of them in the Washington, D.C. area. One of the most prominent things in the D.C. and the Beltway is the Mormon Temple, as you know. There's just religion of all kinds up there. But and we actually believe in our religious freedom, the right for everyone to believe like they do. We don't want to force them to believe like we do either, do we? I mean, that's not religious liberty at all. But at any rate, though we offer religious freedom to these people, and though Saudi Arabia is one of our allies, see if you can get Dale Pollard to go over and hold an evangelistic meeting in Saudi Arabia, or John Earnhardt. Do you understand? The deal is, they would probably be willing to do it if they were invited. But the fact is, if you were to pitch a tent or rent a hall and held an evangelistic meeting, you would have two choices. Get out or die. Isn't that incredible? So there are no Adventist churches per se. But listen carefully. Adventist World Radio covers this earth like Dixie covers the dew. You know what I'm talking about? That's the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Covers Dixie like the dew. I remember that because that's where they posted my results when I took the bar exam in Georgia. Fortunately, I passed. But anyway, boy, that was hard for me to tell you about that. Anyway, Adventist World Radio is giving many hours a week in the Arabic language into all of those countries where we can't go. And I was just at lunch this past week with Ben Schoen at the GC, and he said, Ed, I wish we could tell you the stories of what's happening. We can't print it in our papers because for the safety of the people, but hundreds of people are becoming Sabbath keepers in those Muslim countries. It's incredible what's happening. Absolutely awesome. And God is working in mighty ways. Well, I will just tell you one other interesting thing about this. Those of you who get the review know that just a few weeks ago, in one of the World Editions, you saw the picture of a baptism on the front, and Israel Leyto was baptizing, he's the president of the Inter-American Division, the 3 millionth Adventist in Inter-America. 3 million members now. In South America, the country of Brazil has more than 1 million members just in that one country. It's just incredible. The Adventist Church now is growing at a rate of more than 3,000 people every day of the week. That is a Pentecost every day. Now, the most amazing thing about all of this to me is the fact that we're just beginning to see the latter rain. In many places around the world, it is really, really incredible what is happening. I can tell you stories that would just bring tears to your eyes. I'll tell you one that brought tears to my eyes. Bill Johnson, recently retired editor of the Adventist Review, about 3 years ago, went over to India just to cover the evangelistic meetings in India. Some of you have been to India to help with meetings. Kathy and I went to India, conducted an evangelistic meeting. Incredible experience. Elder Johnson came back and told us at worship this story. He said when Nolene and I, his wife and he, got married, 2 weeks after they graduated from Avondale College in Australia, 2 weeks later, they were on the boat to go as missionaries to India. And they worked there for a number of years. All three of their children were born in India. And the whole time they were there, they saw about five people baptized. This is years and years and years. And he said, I never thought I would live to see what's happening there now. Just thousands and thousands and thousands of people are being baptized. It's just incredible what God is doing. Really, really amazing what he is doing there. Well, I will just tell you that it took over 107 years for our church to reach the first 1 million members. From 1863 to past 1963 for the first 1 million. The last 1 million came in a year and a half. And it's incredible what God is doing. It's amazing what God is doing. I'm going to tell you about a couple of things that you likely know about. I was just recently at Con Arnold's funeral. Some of you remember Con Arnold. He was in Nashville, Tennessee. He was the youth director for a number of conferences and a real friend and mentor to me. And it happens sometimes when somebody's lived a long, full life and people are very proud that they've known this person, that after the sermon, the pastor asked, would anyone like to say anything? And a number of us, I think about 12 of us, got up, and I spoke just briefly. And what I'm going to tell you about, though, is Denzel McNeilis also stood. He was president of ASI for a period of time, as you know, and the son of Garwin McNeilis, and they're very, very faithful supporters of the work. But he said to me, Con Arnold came to my office while, and you know, they were building these concrete mixers up in Dodge Center, Minnesota, and he invited me to join ASI. And he said, I could tell by his attitude that he was not going to leave my office until I said yes. So he said, I really didn't have a great deal of interest in getting involved in anything else, but just to get him to leave, I said, sure, I'll join ASI. Then Denzel stated, when he got up to leave and shook my hand, he wouldn't let go. And he wouldn't let go until I promised him I would come to the next ASI National Convention. Well, now here's the interesting part. And I'm going to tell you this as a former secretary of ASI. When Denzel and Donna McNeilis got involved, they said, we need to get our kids more involved. And so they started getting young people involved until the youth part of it just grew and grew and grew. Then they said, why don't we have an evangelistic meeting? So they encouraged young David Ashrick, a graduate of Mission College, to hold an evangelistic meeting in Florida. Now, every year before ASI National Convention, the young people have a major evangelistic meeting, or several in the community. To date, just the youth of ASI have baptized more than 1,000 people and started 6 or 7 churches from scratch and put a lot of young people in the ministry. I mean, this is incredible. And Denzel and Donna's kids have been involved, and they've been involved themselves. And Denzel said, where would I have been had he not stopped by my office? I mean, this to me is incredible. So each one of us can do something. That's the amazing thing. We can all be involved in some way. Now, we've talked about signs today, and there are significant ones, and there are more significant, you know, things happening all the time. In fact, it's almost hard to keep current on end time things. They happen so fast, really. But in spite of all the signs, sometimes we grow careless in our attitudes and our actions. Sometimes we get distracted from the heavenly goal. One of the things that thrills me more than anything else when I go to camp meeting is to look for people that I think ought to be there. Do you understand what I'm talking about? People I've known before, and when I see that you're still faithful, it's very encouraging to me. The point I'm trying to make from all of that is some people are dropping by the wayside. They get upset with a conference or somebody, or they get distracted by some teacher. Do you understand what I'm talking about? Weird stuff happens. We get attracted to things, to materialism. Sometimes we even get critical of God in His church. And of course, as the Bible predicted, sometimes we get sleepy while waiting for the Lord's return. I want to tell you just quickly an experience I had at Gatlinburg. Kathy and I have been involved with It Is Written as partners for a number of years. We go to one of the partners. I've been a speaker at several of them. But at any rate, we usually go to the Gatlinburg Christmas one or December. It's interesting that we went one time when Mark Finley was still the director and speaker of It Is Written. By the way, I think Sean Boonster is doing a tremendous job. He's a tremendous guy. And Mark Finley now is directing evangelism for the whole world. So, I mean, you couldn't ask for anything better from both of those guys who are really into clear up to their noses. But anyway, Mark Finley was introducing a young man. And some of you may have been there. It's very interesting. He was a Hispanic pastor, a Methodist pastor from New Jersey. And this man had been watching It Is Written, and he sent in a letter stating, "I believe all I've heard. Would you have someone stop and see me?" And the man's name was Eli Maldonado, a Methodist pastor. And he said, Eli was there with him at the It Is Written partnership. He said, "When I dropped that letter in the mailbox at the corner of my street, when I heard it hit the bottom, I knew that my life would never be the same again. In fact, I tried to get it out, but you know, it's not possible." So he said, "Well, I consoled myself by saying, nothing's going to come of this. They get letters from people every day. They get letters from kids. They send them the kids' letter, form letter. They get letters from mothers, send them the mother's letter. And they get letters from pastors, and they'll send them the pastor's letter." But instead, 3 days later, we got a phone call from Mark Finley. And Mark said, "I'm speaking to the Southern Union departmental meetings down in Daytona Beach, and I've taken the liberty to buy you an airline ticket. It will be in the mail. You come down and we'll visit for 3 days as my guest." And they went through Adventism from A to Z. So Eli Maldonado now was giving his testimony why he's decided to become a Sabbath keeper. And he said, "I now only have two questions. The first question, if all this stuff you believe about prophecy is true, why isn't everybody all excited?" Isn't that a good question? Why aren't you guys all excited? And the second question, he said, was, "How could we ever have a Sunday law in America when we are the champions of civil and religious liberty?" Well, after the presentation, Mark brought Eli right over to my table where Kathy and I were sitting and says, "Mark, this is Ed Reed. He'll answer those two questions for you." So I said, "Well, the first one is simple." He said, "Really?" I said, "Yes. Do you know that in Matthew 25, it said, while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. All means the good guys and the bad guys, the wise and the foolish are all conked out. So a sleeping church is itself a sign of the end." Did you know that? But something wakes them up. And by the way, if you study the topic of the latter rain and the pouring out of the latter rain, Ellen White says that many times it will occur at camp meeting. You read about it in the Spirit of Prophecy, latter rain, and you'll at camp meeting several times with it. Pretty amazing. When people are gathered together like at our camp meetings and so on, she says. Well, he said, "Well, what about the other one?" And so I gave him a complimentary copy of my book, Sunday's Coming. He called me 2 weeks later, said, "I've read the whole book, even the appendix." He says, "You're right. I didn't know it could happen like that." What I told you yesterday is still true. The deeper you dig in Adventism, the more solid the foundation. We have something to be very, very proud of. And I think that God has blessed us in many, many ways. Sometimes while we're waiting, we become sleepy or lukewarm. And I think it's in occasions like this at camp meeting when it's good to take stock of ourselves and see what's really important and what really, really matters. So if you don't mind, I'm going to tell you something interesting as we conclude today. Sometimes success is evaluated by people in the wrong terms. Someone asked me after the 11 o'clock presentation about the Appalachian Trail today, how old was our son? Well, he was in law school at UT at the time that we did the Appalachian Trail stuff, but he actually climbed Mount Whitney with me when he was 8 years old, the highest mountain in the continental United States. And so we've enjoyed hiking together. The reason that I tell you that is that I'm not going to be climbing on Mount McKinley or Denali because I don't want, you know, two climbers just fell 2,500 feet to their death just this past week up there. And so I don't do dangerous stuff. I just do strenuous things. So, you know, you could always stop and rest, but not on the way down if you're falling. So listen carefully to what I'm going to tell you now. You may never climb a high mountain. You may never paint a picture. You may never fly an airplane. I passed the FAA ground school and had 13 hours in the left seat of a private plane to get my license. Then the brethren called me to Washington and I had to drop the whole thing. Now, you know, that's awful, isn't it? But the bottom line is, when we get to heaven, we're all going to be pilots automatically. I mean, this is incredible. Okay. You may never visit Hawaii or write a book or finish college or be in the Olympic Games. You may never even attend the Olympic Games. But if you enter heaven, your life is a success. And there is no question about that. On the other hand, your life may be considered a great success by the world standards. You may have gained wealth and recognition and honor, traveled the world, become highly educated. But if you miss heaven, your life is a failure, and there is no question about that either. So the reason that I were going through these signs and the great prophetic timeline is to let us know if we're ever going to get serious about our religious experience, if we're ever going to become Bible students, now is the time to start doing it, it seems to me. Very, very important. So I'd like to leave you with this challenge. Remember that Jesus promised, I will come again. And He asked the question, will I find faith on the earth? I want to be one of the people that says, yes, it's going to be in my heart. Because I'm going over the Word, I'm maintaining a friendship and a relationship with God. Would you like to join Him in telling Him that too, that you'd like to do that? Praise God. Let's have a prayer together as we close. Heavenly Father, I want to thank You for the opportunity we have of being together. May Your Spirit go with us and guide us in this spiritual life journey that we're on. We thank You for the tremendous signs that Your coming is near. And we're thankful also for the great inroads that the gospel is making around the world. And so many laymen and others are getting involved with the New Horizons Bible study materials and other things, going and doing evangelism. May we be good witnesses to You for wherever we go and wherever we are. May Your Spirit fill us. May we have confidence and not become discouraged. And as we look forward to Your kingdom, may we be joined together with You very soon. In Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage you. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry, as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.